Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, Bill Nye, the science guy, calls today's guest a proud nerd. He says whether you're baking a pie, washing your hands, or watching a sunset, Dr. Kate Bieberdorf shows that science is everywhere and it's fun. And that's because Dr. Bieberdorf, or Kate the chemist as she's also known, isn't just a scientist. She's a science entertainer. Her new book is It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. And having read it cover to cover, I can tell you it's really fascinating. And yes, it's a lot of fun, but I also learned things that blew my mind, absolutely blew my mind. So let me tell you about my guest so we can bring her on. Dr. Kate Bieberdorf is a scientist, a science entertainer, and chemistry professor at the University of Texas. She has a PhD in inorganic chemistry from the University of Texas and has published her work in catalysis, science, and technology. Her six-book series for kids with Penguin Young Readers breaks down the image of the stereotypical scientist and reaches those who might otherwise be intimidated or bored by science. She's also appeared on The Today Show, Wendy Williams Show, and Late Night with Stephen Colbert. In fact, I think she's the first woman scientist to appear on a late night show. And she has an abundance of great personality. Check out her website, katethechemist.com. Loads of fun experiments up there and more about her other books. Today, we're talking about It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. Here's my guest, Dr. Kate Bieberdorf. So since we're talking about the elements of chemistry today, I want to just mention that, you know, one of the elements of good writing and communication is humor, and you use a lot of this in the book. Is that something that comes naturally to you?
I would say yes, but my husband would probably say no. I like to make jokes. I like to make science fun and entertaining. And I know I have personally had the professor that is going on this boring lecture, and he just like the voice is monotone, and you just can't keep interested. And it's heartbreaking for me whenever I hear these stories. I mean, like I said, because I've been in this exact same position. And so what I wanted to do in the book was just use little anecdotes throughout the science, and use just different examples and different fun little stories to try to illustrate the science. That's really truly the main reason of adding that. But I also want to add a little humor because I want it to be fun. This isn't meant to be a textbook. There's hundreds and thousands of chemistry textbooks out there. Like, nobody wants to read that. And so I just wanted to do chemistry justice and make it fun and exciting.
Well, you do make it fun and exciting, and you apply it to everyday life, such as showering or happy hour or getting up in the morning and putting out, you know, lipstick and makeup. So it makes it all very, very accessible. And I, too, had that chemistry teacher. I loved chemistry until I moved schools, and then I had a guy who obviously hated teaching at an all-girls school and didn't want to be there. And so, unfortunately,
no.
Chemistry became an hour where I could just goof off, which is quite sad, really. So we need people like you in the world, and we need this book. Again, it's called Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry of Everything. And you teach a class at University of Texas called Chemistry in Context. Tell us a little bit about that and why it's so popular.
Well, sure. So I generally teach general chemistry, either for majors or non-majors. And the Chemistry in Context course is specifically for non-science majors. And so you can picture maybe a student who's a business student, or maybe they're a foreign language student, but for whatever reason, they have to take a science class. And so this is the best chance for them, like actually enjoying a science class, is what Chemistry in Context is. And so it's essentially what we do is we teach all real-world examples of science, and then I kind of sneak that the hard parts of science in there, the stoichiometry. I teach them what a mole is, but we start with a real-world example and then kind of sneak the chemistry in on the side. Whereas when we teach for majors, you really just dive straight into the hardcore science, the math, the really difficult equations. And then at the end of the lecture, it's like, oh, by the way, you will also find this in lipstick or mascara or whatever it is. Right. And so what I love about the chemistry and context class is we can actually start with, okay, who likes lipstick? Let's talk about the three molecules that are in lipstick or anything like that.
Right, right. As I was showering and making my coffee this morning, I was thinking chemistry. But I want to talk just a little bit about science in general before we dive into the book, because it's become painfully apparent over the last couple of years that a lot of people don't understand that science, first of all, is not an absolute. And secondly, a lot of people don't even believe in science. They don't seem to understand that the more we learn, the more findings we get. You know, theories may change along the way. Share your perspective on that, if you would.
Oh, absolutely. It is so frustrating because we as scientists approach everything by seeing data. We've done an experiment, we have some results, and the entire purpose of, and the fun part, in my opinion, of being a scientist is now we come up with a theory to explain that. And so then once we have a theory, all we do is a bunch of different experiments to try to break that theory down. Say, if X works, then Y should work. But if we get Z, that means that our theory is incorrect. And so we constantly just chip away at these theories until we can get our most perfect, you know, best case, or like, you know, this is the complete way we think these pieces work. This is how we think these molecules operate. And it's just, it's a very fun way to try to kind of explore the things around you. And so what I think non-scientists sometimes forget is that we're always asking questions as scientists. We're always trying to find answers. And if we do an experiment that breaks our theory down, then what we do is fine-tune that theory. We take it a step further. We add a little amendment to it, and we just make our theories better. And so we've seen this happen over the last year and a half with everything with COVID. You know, in the very beginning, we only knew a small amount of information, and over the last 18 months or so, we've been able to really chip away and figure out, oh, okay, we think it works this way, or oh, it has a spike protein, that's important. And we've been able to really build off of each other's things. And yes, there are some things that we had in the beginning. We didn't think masks were going to be helpful, but now we know for sure, without a doubt, that masks are helpful. They're very good for us. They help stop the spread of COVID or minimize it. And so it's something that it's very frustrating when non-scientists try to say, like, oh, well, you were wrong. It's like, well, that happens all the time. We're just fine-tuning our theories, and now we have a pretty good one. We really think we have an idea of what's going on, but we're always going to make our theories better.
Absolutely. I'm sure it must be very frustrating. And of course, with all the variants coming in, you know, things are going to keep changing and, you know, evolving. So we appreciate the good work. I appreciate the good work that scientists do. You know, I have a friend who, he loves to cook, and he especially loves to bake, because he considers when he's baking, it's his experimental lab. And you have a great chapter in the book. He says it's all about the science, and of course he's right, because if you don't mix exactly the right measurements, your cakes won't rise, your bread won't be soft, your pie crust will be soggy or like cardboard. And I was interested to see this chapter in your book because during the heart of the pandemic, I started baking like a lot of people, right? I hadn't baked for ages, and I got tons of recipes off the web. And I'd say about 99% of them were awful. And in your,
awful.
You're awful, really, like throw in the trash after one bite, awful, and not even give out to the birds. And so I read in your book that we should always use scales, you know, because it is such a chemistry experiment. So talk to us a little bit about baking and chemistry from your perspective.
Well, anytime you're in the kitchen, like it or not, you're being a scientist, because you are doing chemical reactions. Sometimes it's even just physical changes, but you're allowing yourself to take butter and sugar and flour and turn it into a pie or cookies or maybe brownies if you add cocoa powder. And so one of the things that I've learned as a chemist is that scales are a really easy way to measure something, and then you can just dump it into a bowl. I personally have a favorite pie crust that I use that has something like, it's the most annoying measurement. It's something like 2 cups of flour and then like 2.5 teaspoons of flour. Right. It's so annoying. Or you can just do 184 grams and you just measure it out with a scale, and you don't have to think like, oh shoot, did I do 2 cups? Did I do 3 cups? And so that's one of the things I love about a scale. It's accurate. You're going to make sure you have the perfect ratio of flour to sugar to butter or whatever it is you're using. And it's actually easier. If you need 184 grams, you just measure it out, get to 184, and then dump it into your bowl instead of getting the cup out, then you need the half cup, then you need the 2 teaspoons, and just, ugh, that's too much for me. I love just using the scale. And they're inexpensive. You can get an easy kitchen scale online for, it's honestly quite inexpensive, and you will completely notice a change in your cooking. Your baking specifically.
Yeah, I read somewhere after about my fifth disaster that it depends on how you aerate your flour and all that stuff if you're using cups and spoons. So it makes sense now. Now I understand that side of it. So one of the things you do is you just run through a typical day, things we might do. And of course, most of us, that starts with coffee. And you talk about caffeine, and you know, we've done health shows on caffeine and nutrition and stuff, but it's really interesting seeing it from a chemist's point of view. And I didn't know this before until I read your book, that you say caffeine doesn't give us energy, but it actually blocks other molecules from making us feel sleepy. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
I think people have this incredible misconception about caffeine and how it works. But caffeine is this beautiful molecule. It's trimethylxanthine. It's an odorless white powder, and it acts just like a psychoactive drug, so just like nicotine or morphine does. So it essentially messes with the way our brains function or behave. And so what happens is this trimethylxanthine, or caffeine, binds with the receptors in our brain that are meant to bind to a completely different molecule. So that molecule is called adenosine, and it is the one that is used for our body to make us feel sleepy or drowsy. So when caffeine comes in, it binds with the receptors, and it essentially blocks adenosine from doing its thing and making us feel drowsy. And so it doesn't actually give us energy, caffeine specifically, it just blocks another molecule from making us feel sleepy. And I think that's just so neat, because I mean, everybody's under the impression that it's a stimulant and it gives us boosts, and it's just all the way we talk about that. It's our vernacular is a little bit twisted.
Right, exactly. That's the way I've always looked at it, as a stimulant. It's really interesting. Now I'm going to look at it slightly differently. Even the way we make our coffee can have an impact, right? Whether we percolate or we drip or we French press.
Absolutely. And it's all about the surface area of that bean. So if you want to take just coffee beans and throw it into hot water, you will be able to dissolve some of that trimethylxanthine into the hot water and get your caffeine that way. But I'm pretty sure anybody who drinks coffee would tell you that's disgusting. That is not the best way to drink coffee. And so most people want to grind it up, maybe even use pressure on the bean itself. And so there's a lot of different ways you can extract that trimethylxanthine molecule from the bean. And so in general, what you would see is that the more surface area you have of your beans, the more ground up it is, the more easily you're going to be able to extract that trimethylxanthine. But if you have something like a solid bean, it's just going to be more difficult because there's a lot of the molecules are at the center of that bean, and so they're not exposed to the water, and it needs the water to form that intermolecular force, so soluble piece. I'm not going to go too much into that science, but it needs to be exposed to the water, and if it can't touch the water molecules, it can't dissolve in. But honestly, I think coffee is a lot about personal preference. What do you like? What do you enjoy? I am not a coffee drinker, so I try to stay away from, like, what's the best way to drink your coffee, because
right.
It all tastes gross to me. I'm a Diet Coke girl, so I need my soda, but I have an entire chapter on this because so many people love coffee, and there's so much chemistry in it. It's just fascinating.
Right. And you say if we like a juice in the morning, the best to drink are cranberry and tomato.
Yeah, they are, because they have have the least amount of sugar. They're really good for you. They're quite healthy. You're going to get a lot of your vitamins. You're going to get some minerals out of there as well. Those are really good ones. But again, it's all about your preference. So if you're going to drink something that's unhealthy for you, I'm going to encourage you to drink any juice over that. Soda's terrible for you, so don't do what I do. But it's a lot about just trying to make sure you get those vitamins and minerals into your body.
Right, and we hear a lot about eating our vegetables and our fruits for our vitamins, but we don't hear so much about minerals. But you say they're really just charged atoms or ions, which is another way of looking at them. What do we need to know about minerals and why they're so essential to a healthy diet?
Sure. Well, I think probably if I use the word electrolyte or salt, people would be a lot more familiar with the term. But essentially, that's all minerals are, is that they're ions, which means it's an atom in a charged state. So we have a lot of atoms that are in the positive state, like minerals, I should say. So we use some calcium, magnesium, but even potassium. Our most common negative one is chlorine. We have a lot of chlorine in our body. But we have tons of different minerals that we need to eat on a daily basis. And so we have macro minerals. Those are ones where we need to eat about 1 to 2 grams a day. There's micro minerals. So you need just, obviously micros. So you don't need as much. And then there's trace minerals where you just need a few micrograms. And so that could be something like iodine or boron or even chromium. But they're all over the place. And so you just want to eat a well-balanced diet. And the healthier you eat, the better it is for you, obviously. I'm a big fan of your broccoli, your lettuce, tomatoes, your avocados. If you eat just those four things, you're going to get hit with calcium, chlorine, magnesium, potassium, phosphorus, sodium, sulfur. I could go on and on. So there's so much goodness for you. And just by eating some veggies, then you're doing a lot of chemistry and you don't even have to think about it.
Right. Yeah, good to know. I'm going to jump to another chapter now. I just randomly picked a couple of questions out of chapters that I wanted to cover here. And working out is important. And I think especially since so many of us have been cooped up for so long, and I keep hearing about how everybody's gained weight, including myself, because they haven't been working out so much. And I found this interesting. You say when our muscles become trained, we are teaching them how to operate and function properly. So what's their job when they function properly?
Oh, great question. Essentially, what they do is they allow for us to store some ATP. And so ATP is one of the best molecules we have. It's our molecular unit of currency. And to step back just a little bit, we get ATP anytime we eat food. So any snack you have, I'm also guilty of gaining weight over the pandemic because I've been eating more processed foods. But no matter what you eat and when you put it into your body, the very first step is that your body is going to digest it, right? So you're going to take your whatever it is that you've eaten, your enzymes are going to come in, the ones that are sitting in your intestine, in your stomach, and they're going to break apart that food and form glucose. And then after you form glucose, the second step in the process is to go through glycolysis. And that's what happens when you actually break that glucose down. Now, the next part gets a little complicated, but I'm just going to say essentially you have some molecules that enter the citric acid cycle. And once they've entered that, we are able to form carbon dioxide and a bunch of other molecules that essentially form ATP. Long-winded answer, but that's how you get your ATP. So it's all from eating food and breaking it down and digesting it. So once you have this ATP, what it does is it's going to be sitting in your mitochondria. So it's sitting inside these cells and it's stored all over your body. So you actually have 1 billion molecules of ATP in every single cell in your body. 1 billion molecules in every cell in your body. And then the coolest part is anytime you do something, so you reach for a glass that's falling over, you run for the bus, or you do some jumping jacks, you essentially burn this ATP. So you have a combustion reaction in your body. And so it's hot. That's why we get hot when we do workouts. Our body temperature is actually building up because it's exothermic. It releases energy. And so then it happens, we burn this ATP off. And when you burn the ATP off, you produce water and carbon dioxide. And so you exhale out all of your fat. So you're burning this ATP, and then you exhale chill out, and the carbon dioxide molecules that have gone through this entire process from starting at your food, going through all this stuff, to turning into this, and then being released in the carbon dioxide, it's going out your lungs, and you're exhaling your fat, and I just think it's like one of the neatest processes. And I try to not go too deep into the science, into the book. I definitely walk through it because I don't want to overload you with it, and I definitely stay on the chemistry side, but I used to be a fitness instructor, so I also love the workout part. I love the clothing. I love the science
right.
anywhere there. It's just so much fun.
Right, and you talk about the best clothing to wear in there too. It's quite fascinating when you start looking at things through your eyes, basically. You know, I'll be really honest, Kate, I had to read that bit twice in the book where you talked about the science of how we lose weight is that we actually exhale out our fat. I was like, what? And then I started breathing out. I started breathing out a lot. But I know that's not what you mean. If only. So let's talk about dopamine a little, if we could. I've been reading a lot about this lately, and motivation, and you know how the hormones kick in, epinephrine. And my mom had Parkinson's disease, which of course is totally related to dopamine, and the neurotransmitter stops firing correctly. And I've also been listening to a doctor called Andrew Huberman, who's a neurobiologist, about the importance of dopamine in motivation, or at least in creating the craving to do something. Could you tell us what we need to know about dopamine from your perspective? Because you have a slightly different way of explaining it than he did, and it made sense to me.
Sure. I think of dopamine as one of the molecules that essentially works to give us a little bit of happiness. And so there's a lot of different ways you can think about it. And again, I stay on the chemistry side. But when I started dipping into it is when I talk about adrenaline. And so adrenaline is essentially epinephrine, and it's an amino acid-derived hormone. And a lot of times when I talk about working out in the classroom, my athletes, any of my amazing athletes who are also taking chemistry, immediately want to talk about adrenaline rushes. And so I'm an adrenaline junkie, so I totally get that. But essentially what happens is after you do a workout, you are often getting adrenaline. That is happening 100%, but you're also, your body is also releasing tons and tons of dopamine. And as the dopamine is released, your body starts to feel that, and you get that joy, you get that happiness part, and essentially you're kind of rewarded for doing that amazing workout. And so I get those adrenaline rushes and those dopamine highs anytime I've done a really intense workout. I did a kickboxing class this morning, and at the end of it I felt so happy and so amazing. And we're trained to think it's an adrenaline rush, but truthfully it's the fact that our body has been releasing dopamine and our body seeks that out. So anytime that we talk about an adrenaline rush or someone being an adrenaline junkie, you're actually just a dopamine junkie. You know that after you do a workout, you feel happier, and so certain people seek out those activities, and it's just a way to trick their body into releasing dopamine and making them feel happier.
Mm. So one of the last chapter actually in the book is called Let's Get It On in the Bedroom, and you talk about a lot of stuff in there. You talk about many topics from light to roosters, and you bust the common belief that humans give off any kind of sex pheromone. We're told that a lot, but you say no.
No, I do not. I do not think that humans have any sex pheromones. That's true.
And we should explain what that is.
Okay, a lot of misconceptions out there about what is true and not, but our current true data says that humans do not give off sex pheromones. One of the reasons why people believe that is a horrendous study was done years and years ago, and this person was going around and collecting sweat from some humans. A lot of times it was just like collected under the armpits of certain humans, and then they froze those samples for a year. And then the next year they take the samples out and they put it on the upper lip of women.
Oh,
and then they like tracked how they reacted to this sweat, this armpit sweat that they put on other people's faces. And this lady then claims that, oh, we can absolutely see that there's a sex pheromone and these women are acting differently. And it's all garbage. It's all garbage science. There's nothing to back that up at all. At the time of the when I published the book, and still I think to this day, nothing has been published on it. So we know that animals for sure have sex pheromones. sounds, but humans do not. And we honestly think, though, it's because humans learn to communicate. We have the English language. We have different types of languages where we can talk to each other. And we also have different types of body language. We can put on lingerie, or we can light a candle to send a signal to our partner and let them know how we're feeling.
Yeah, so we don't have to walk up to them and start sniffing them.
No, I hope not.
So in a nutshell, aphrodisiacs, do they work or not?
I don't know. Gosh, you're going to put me on the spot. I tend to say no. I have to say no. I think it's more about the fact that your partner knows how to read your signals. And I think we're good at sending signals, and certain communities have different ways of doing that. I loved my research when I was looking at all these different aphrodisiacs. There were chocolate-covered beetles. There was a lobster, like, soup or something that was an aphrodisiac in another country. And so it's just whatever your community has learned to use to communicate from one partner to another. So I believe in the human language. I believe in body language. I believe in sending signals. Do I think a candle turns you on? Probably not.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because, I mean, think about it. How many times have you been out to dinner with someone and one of them's ordered oysters and everyone starts nudging each other, you know?
Right.
Yeah, the body language, yeah, yeah. I sometimes listen to this entrepreneur who has a podcast and a school where he teaches people, and he talks about his relationship with his wife. He talks purely in chemical and biological terms. And some of it makes sense, because he says if more people understood the science of relationships and the hormones we give off, how they fluctuate and affect our moods, etc., there'd be fewer breakups and stronger connections, probably. What do you say to that?
Maybe. I know that my husband doesn't particularly love when I start talking about chemistry all day, every day. But he is a chemist, so I can suck him into those conversations. But I think some people might get sick of it after a while. I don't know. Not me. I love it.
So I want to talk about STEM before we go. You thank Mary Jackson in the back of your book, the first black female engineer at NASA, for being a role model in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And you also say that only 3% of your students graduate as chemistry majors. Yet, as you write in the book, chemistry explains all the phenomena around us while helping us to understand the fabric of our reality. So how do we get, I mean, you're doing a great job here. I'm assuming you're going to have some impact on this 3%. But how do we get people, kids engaged in science at early age?
Well, I mean, honestly, like you said, it's getting out there. It's doing our part, reaching into the community and trying to find the kids who can benefit from these conversations. But I also think part of it is talking to the adults, talking to the parents, and getting parents excited about science. Because like what we said in the very beginning here, when you have that horrible class with that high school chemistry class that's terrible and you hated it, you might pass that stigma or that negative feeling onto your kid about not liking science. And so what I hope I can do with this book is kind of rebrand chemistry, make it fun, make it exciting, so that when the kids start asking questions to their parents, they can admit, A, oh, I don't know the answer to that question. That is a great question. Let's figure it out together. So they're being scientists together. They're investigating these questions. But I also think if we get parents excited about science, they're more willing to give up their Saturday and bring their kids to some science festival that's all day long and hang out, because I mean that's a sacrifice too. Parents need to take care of their mental health, and so I think if we can make science fun for families in general, kids, parents, grandmas, grandpas, everybody, then we're just going to make science a better place. I mean, look at what's happening right now. Our scientists are our superheroes. Without them, we would be totally struggling in this pandemic, and we at least have a shot at coming out on the other end here now because of them.
Absolutely. And my 15-year-old niece earned a STEM scholarship last year, and it was supposed to go into effect last year, but it got postponed because of COVID. But she's earned a STEM scholarship to a special program that introduces young women to all of those fields, because she wants to get into engineering in an environmental fashion. And so I'm definitely going to introduce her to your work, because I think it's wonderful. I think what you're doing is great. If I'd had you as a teacher, who knows what I might have done?
Well, thank thank you for you encouraging her. That's just one more scientist. So please tell her that she can reach out to me anytime she needs anything. We are a team together. I refer to it as my STEM army. We're all going to conquer the world together. So now she's part of the army.
That's lovely. And so what do you want to leave listeners with? What do you want to let them know that we haven't discussed today? What do you want them to take away?
Well, the one thing that drives me nuts, so I will say this, is that everything's a molecule. So if you can see it, breathe it, taste it, interact with it, it's a molecule. And so I hope that just by either listening to this conversation or maybe reading a little bit from the book, that people will understand that everything they do on a daily basis is being a chemist and interacting with the world and the atoms and the molecules around them in a fun way. And so I hope the book just makes it fun, makes it entertaining, and just like you said, now when you, after you've read it, you start walking around and it's like, oh my gosh, there's chemistry in my coffee, it's also in my Instant Pot, it's in my gym bag, it's literally everywhere.
It's in my bubbles, in my shower.
Yeah,
I know listeners can find out much more about you, Kate, at katethechemist.com. The book is called It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. And you've got some great stuff on your website. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Sure. I have a couple books. As you know, this one is for adults, but I've also written tons of books for kids. On the website, there's also links to my TikTok and Instagram. You can follow me at Kate the Chemist on both of those websites. I'm fairly new to TikTok, so if you all have any experiments, you have any ideas that you think I should do, please send them my way because I love that. But I also have a couple of clips for any time I'm on the national TV because I love visiting the Today Show and Colbert and Kelly Clarkson. We were just on their show and Wendy Williams, so I try to link to any of my up-to-date segments because it's just fun blowing stuff up celebrities.
Right. I can imagine. Well, I really appreciate you being with us today and sharing your enthusiasm for chemistry, and it certainly has made me think and look at things differently. I read that book cover to cover. It is really entertaining and very informative. So job well done, Kate. Thanks for being with us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.